Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week.
The President's Inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
Israeli airstrikes on Gaza are flattening neighborhoods. Escalation is expected. A rabbi in Jerusalem sees an agonizing paradox.
It's horrible. I don't want any civilians to be killed. I don't want people to have this terror and this fear.
But she says she doesn't want missiles landing at home. Also, we check in on U.S. efforts to improve Arab-Israeli relations.
It was a lot of misguided thinking to think that the central focus of America's Middle East policy should be Israeli-Arab normalization, and that would magically make the Israeli-Palestinian conflict go away.
I'm Marco Werman. Later on the show, Australians will vote on a permanent advisory body for Indigenous people, but not all Indigenous Australians are on board.
I do understand the argument something is better than nothing, but is something bad better than nothing at all?
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Wednesday. It has been 5 days of war since the start of Hamas's surprise and deadly attack on Israel. This afternoon, Secretary of State Antony Blinken left for Israel and made these comments on the tarmac at Joint Base Andrews near Washington.
We've seen the almost indescribable acts committed by Hamas against Israeli men, women, and children. Every day, we're learning more, and it is simply heartbreaking. Not since ISIS have we seen this kind of depravity.
A show of U.S. support as tensions ratchet up further. There were more Israeli airstrikes on Gaza and Israeli troops massing at the border today. Grisly new details are also emerging about how Israelis were killed in their homes by Hamas militants on Saturday. This rising tension isn't just at Israel's border with Gaza, but also in the north near the border with Lebanon. Ariel Osaran spent the day there. He's a reporter with I-24 News in Israel. Ariel, rockets have been coming from Hezbollah in Lebanon for the past few days. Tell us what's going on there and what Israel might be concerned about at the northern border.
Well, Marco, there's a lot going on the northern border. You have rocket barrages going on since Saturday. You also have an infiltration of Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorists who carried out a fierce firefight with Israeli soldiers, killing 3 soldiers on the border. You also had Hezbollah launching anti-tank guided missiles at Israeli outposts. And this has really raised the bar. I mean, we haven't seen these many Hezbollah attacks in a row so consecutively since 2006, the last major conflict between Hezbollah and Israel. So that is one thing. That's what's going on now. But what has Israel concerned is a two-front war, perhaps more, between Hamas in Gaza in the south, Hezbollah up in the north, and the fear not only that Hezbollah is significantly stronger than Hamas. Israel does not want to put itself in a position of a multi-front war, one that could perhaps spread out into potentially a regional war with U.S. forces arriving in the region, and even Yemen threatening to attack U.S. interests in the region if the war continues and if Iran's proxies are joined into the fray, Hezbollah being the main one of them in the region.
And remind us briefly what Hezbollah is and its relationship to Hamas.
So Hezbollah is the main facilitator, one can say, between Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Iran, and the Assad regime, forming one kind of unified axis that has been cooperating a lot, meeting a lot, and it is believed that even held meetings regarding Saturday's attack, all parties involved.
Turning to the rest of Israel, what is the latest on Israeli troop movements and continued airstrikes into Gaza?
Well, in terms of movements of military forces, I mean, there's no secret that Israel is amassing a large amount of forces along its southern border with Gaza. In general, Israel has already called up more than 300,000 reservists. That's the biggest number in its history. And that's as part of its response to its single deadliest day in its history. So Israel is showing here a different response, and it's also a more forceful response regarding its bombing inside the Gaza Strip, carrying out dozens, hundreds of attacks against what it says are Hamas targets. Now, obviously, we all seen the images of the widespread destruction there, including entire neighborhoods destroyed. We're seeing, just as on the Israeli side, the death toll is rising as the picture is clearing up of the atrocities that took place in the border communities. So is the death toll on the Palestinian side rising.
A ground invasion by Israel into Gaza has been spoken of widely, but is there a sense that it is inevitable?
Well, it's inevitable because, I mean, first of all, Israel has entered the Gaza Strip on the ground in the past and for less. And given that this is the biggest, deadliest tragedy that Israel has ever witnessed in its history, it sees that it needs to employ the most severe and unusual scope of forces. Now, not only forces have been sent to the south, but also many, many forces have been sent to the north, not only to the northern border. I was there for the past 2 days. There's also a significant military presence around border communities on the routes connecting them, also anticipating a potential flare-up of that border, and that would require many forces very quickly acting together, but also following the conclusions of what happened on Saturday in the southern border communities, that the military wasn't there. Now they're bolstering the security of the northern border communities in anticipation for whatever may happen next.
And what about any news about a proposed humanitarian corridor to get Palestinian civilians out of Gaza?
So as of now, there's no talk of any humanitarian steps on either side, whether it's regarding release of between 100 and 200 hostages that are in the Gaza Strip, or allowing medicine and aid to enter, but also to allow Gazans to exit, because they only have two places to go. They can go to Israel or they can go to Egypt, and Israel is not going to take them. And Egypt so far has not been too open to taking them. And so there aren't really any humanitarian talks in advanced stages, only reports about the existence of said talks. But as of now, that's not on the priority list of any of the sides, it appears.
I know more terrible details are coming out about how Hamas went about killing Israelis in their homes on Saturday. What is the latest on that, and what have you seen in terms of how that news is affecting Israelis?
That's one of the most traumatic aspects of this, Marco. I mean, for Israelis to hear the accounts of horrific brutality, entire families gunned down in their homes, over 1,200 Israelis killed in one day, it's taken its toll.
Ariel Osaran is a reporter with I-24 News in Israel. He's been speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Ariel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Hamas, the Palestinian militants, that is a name that you've been hearing a lot in recent days. In the long story of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Hamas is actually a relatively new organization. For more background on the group and what it wants, we turn to the world's Matthew Bell. First question, Matthew, when was Hamas founded?
It emerged in the late 1980s. That was during the first Palestinian Intifada. That was the uprising against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. The name Hamas in Arabic is an acronym. It stands for the Islamic Resistance Movement, and it's really the Palestinian offshoot of the much older Muslim Brotherhood that started in Egypt in the late 1920s. The founding charter of Hamas was put out in 1988. It lays out the ideology of the group. Hamas does not recognize the legitimacy of the state of Israel at all. Hamas is essentially sworn to the destruction of Israel and aims to replace the country with Islamic rule over the whole region, and especially over the holy city of Jerusalem.
But to be clear, Hamas is just one faction, right?
That's right. In the Gaza Strip, the next group to mention is probably Islamic Jihad. It's funded by Iran, also committed to the destruction of Israel. And then you have in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, there are numerous other factions there. The most influential one is Fatah. It's the dominant faction that controls the Palestinian Authority. The PA, as it's known, grew out of the peace process, and it does have some administrative control across the West Bank. It cooperates with Israel.
So with that background, Matthew, what has Hamas been messaging about this latest attack?
On Sunday, Marco, as Israeli troops were still fighting Hamas attackers in Israeli towns near the Gaza border, Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of Hamas, put out a statement on television. Here's part of it as broadcast on Al Jazeera's English language channel.
Al-Aqsa typhoon started from Gaza, and it will stretch to reach West Bank, 1948 territories, and our people across our territories. This is the battle of not only the Palestinians or the Gazans, it is the battle of all the Arab and Muslim nations.
Haniyeh's statement echoes the longstanding worldview of Hamas, that this is a religious conflict, not just a political one, and that it's a fight against Israel itself, not only the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. At times over the years, Hamas leaders have appeared to be ready to moderate their positions in certain ways. In 2006, the group even won an election. But Israel, the U.S., and Western nations tried to isolate Hamas using sanctions. In 2007, Hamas responded by violently seizing control of the Gaza Strip. It has ruled over a population of 2 million Palestinians there ever since.
Sanctioning Palestinians after the 2006 elections was the first step on the road that led us to where we are.
Nur Odeh is with a Palestinian civil society organization called Miftah in the West Bank. Odeh says she's no fan of Hamas, but that the international community made a huge mistake when it drove the group into a corner, allowing it to play the victim and win support from a disillusioned Palestinian public.
When you punish a group for winning those elections and not give them a chance to govern and be responsible, and then possibly, very possibly, be voted out.
Odeh says the international community can take a lot of the blame for not delivering on the peace process. That helped create a situation where groups like Hamas, she says, have been able to thrive. Odeh says she was shocked by the attack in southern Israel over the weekend, and that she's worried about what comes next in Gaza, where many of her friends live. Israelis are shocked as well, says Doron Avital. He's an ex-Israeli military commander and a former member of Israel's parliament. Avital says, in recent years, a consensus took hold among Israeli leaders that Hamas could be managed, that the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank could be weakened and there would be no consequences.
And then we heavily invested in all those barrier and the underground barrier and the fences and the electronics and the cyber and the sea border, and we felt that it's controllable.
Avital says this recent attack by Hamas shows that the group is not moderating its views toward Israel. He's also frustrated by the far-right Israeli government under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Avital says it has bolstered the standing of Hamas in Gaza by fueling the political divisions among Palestinians.
We always wanted to make clear that this conflict is a national conflict on territorialism, statehood, and things of this sort, and never move to the religious dimension of the conflict. And I would say, and Hamas, of course, makes it a religious conflict. And there are people in Israel, of course, in the right wing, and they're also pushed to this direction.
Now, Avital says Israel's leaders are looking at several options for dealing with Hamas, and all of them are bad. One big question is about Iran. It has long supported Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran has proxies in Syria as well. So Israel's military commanders are looking at a possible doomsday scenario of not just fighting Hamas, but a multi-front war on its borders. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
Coming up in just a moment, what this new war looks like from inside Israel.
sometimes we're just raw, sometimes we're just broken, and we can't seek to fix it. We can just be in it.
This rabbi in Israel wants civilians in Gaza to be safe, but also fears for her own security. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. People in Israel are grappling with a grim, complex new reality. That includes shocking scenes of carnage on both sides of their border with Gaza. The ethical dimensions of this escalating conflict can be hard to reconcile. For one perspective, we reached out to Rabbi Susan Silverman in Jerusalem. She's an author, teacher, activist, and mother of five children. When I spoke with her earlier this morning, I asked her to describe what she's been seeing and feeling the past few days.
You know, it's like 9/11. It's like 9/11 here. And so everybody's impacted. Everybody knows people who are missing, who were killed. I mean, the irony being so many peace activists on those kibbutzim around the Gaza border who've been murdered and kidnapped, and just the horrificness of it. And, you know, watching my kids also respond, you know, and they live in the center of the country. So they're, you know, running to bomb shelters. But this point, it feels like missiles feel like light compared to what was happening to people face to face in that pogrom.
I mean, you described it as Israel's 9/11. I imagine that's not just in terms of scale, but also it's not just one event that ends. It's going to go on for a while. So what did it feel like to wake up again this morning to this new reality facing Israel?
It's absolutely terrifying. And, you know, here, army is mandatory, and our older son in the army was on the Gaza border and was protecting these kibbutzim. He knows them inside out. And I, you know, we're a good lefty family. And I would say to him, honey, what's going on? There are Israeli soldiers shooting. And he would say, Mom, there are people at this fence screaming death to the Jews who want to come and murder and kidnap people on the kibbutzim. Like, yeah, we're shooting at people sometimes. Like, the alternative is people bursting in. And, you know, I was like, wow, okay. You know, I kind of like, I have this very peacenik orientation. And boy, was he right.
Does it feel like your country's very survival is on the line right now?
I hate to even say it out loud, but I do. We're always seen as like this big, strong Israel. But the truth is we are deeply, deeply vulnerable. And in a position of, you know, being like, either kill us or force us to kill civilians. I mean, it's a nightmare. The whole thing is a nightmare.
Rabbi, you mentioned the people living on the kibbutzim, and you called them peace activists. Explain what they were being activists for.
For example, Vivian Silver, who was abducted and is being held hostage in Gaza right now, is the founder of Women Wage Peace. And she had this organization. They would go to the Gaza border, and Palestinians and Israeli Jews would stand at that border and talk to each other and hold hands. And like, she's one of these like visionary dreamers of a liberal, democratic Jewish state. Our youngest is still in the army, and she's on a base toward the north. And she said that just the phone calls keep coming in, and then the soldier receiving the call screams and falls to their knees sobbing. It's just Wow. Everywhere. It's a small country. Everybody knows people.
How do you, as a religious leader, as a rabbi, respond to people looking for some kind of understanding or solace right now?
There really just isn't right now. There just isn't. Sometimes we're just raw. Sometimes we're just broken, and we can't seek to fix it. We can just be in it.
After months of protests against Prime Minister Netanyahu and his moves toward this massive reform of Israel's judiciary, do you see a sudden feeling of pulling together, of unity at this moment?
It's not surprising. I mean, I think anyone under siege, I think people pull together. But, you know, I mean, I've been at basically every protest. I've been very active in the resistance against Bibi and his government and his fascist cronies. But, you know, this just pulled us to a space where it's very hard to look past this moment. Soon we will. But for now, mm-mm.
On Sunday, as you probably heard, the Israeli Ministry of Defense described Hamas as animals. When you heard that for the first time, how did you react?
I mean, listen, it's a terrible thing to say. For me, focusing on that in any way right now is like insanity. I very strongly dislike many people in our government, but I can't focus on that right now. There was just a slaughter, beheading of babies. Like someone said that they're animals. Okay, like I don't think that's like our focus right now. AOC posted like a video of some...
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yes, a video of some total horrible person at a pro-Israel rally saying we should flatten Gaza. And that's like what she's focused on. Some person who has no authority, no nothing, is just an American says that on camera. Like, I don't understand people. Like, can we give us 2 minutes to count our dead before having to like defend ourselves for having like deserved what we got, you know?
Yeah. There are a lot of Gazans who do not support Hamas or their attack on Israel. Civilians have now evacuated their homes and are awaiting worsening strikes from Israel. How are you thinking about them right now?
Oh, just, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. And it's a horrible, horrible thing to have to decide between destroying where missiles are coming from at you, where attackers are coming from at you, and then the civilians that are around there. I think it was David Grossman who was entering a discussion during the last big Gaza war, 2014, like the, you know, ground troops and everything. And
Grossman being a very well-known Israeli novelist.
Correct. Right. He said, ask me whatever you want. But before you do, I want you to picture being in your child's bedroom and the person across the street is shooting guns into that bedroom with a kid on their lap. You know, like, it's horrible. I don't want any civilians to be killed. I don't want people to have this terror and this fear. And I don't want to have missiles landing on us and people coming in beheading babies either. So like this impossible situation for which I think everyone deserves some empathy, you know.
Rabbi Susan Silverman joined us from Jerusalem. Thank you very much for your time, indeed.
Marco, thank you so much.
Returning to another major story we've been following, the massive earthquake and aftershocks in Afghanistan over the weekend. This morning, another strong quake shook the same region of Herat with equal intensity as Saturday's 6.3 magnitude. That first quake killed more than 2,000 people and turned entire villages to rubble. Casualties from today's earthquake are not yet known. It has been reported that in one village, Chauhak, 700 homes still standing after last weekend's quake were leveled. People in that village had already moved into tents, fearing aftershocks like this one. Neighboring Pakistan is among the countries that have offered assistance, but that humanitarian aid has been on hold since Monday, awaiting clearance by the Taliban government in Kabul. More global news is still ahead this hour. You're listening to The World. Costa Rica is officially a Catholic country, but the president is catering to evangelicals. He was even sworn in on a Bible and blessed by a pastor. A religion expert tells us, if you look at this in its historical context, this was a really big thing. Cultivating Christian unity through ambiguity, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More than 2 months after the military seized power in Niger in West Africa, the U.S. has formally recognized that as a coup. That label is significant. It means U.S. assistance to Niger will be reduced to a trickle, and what remains will be strictly focused on humanitarian assistance. Hundreds of millions of dollars for other projects will get nixed. Cameron Hudson has been in on conversations with countries in the region about what to do about the coup d'etat in Niger. He's a former official with the National Security Council and former CIA analyst for Africa. 2 months seems a long time for the U.S. government to determine that the military takeover in Niger was a coup d'etat, Cameron. Why?
We knew that it was a coup d'etat when it happened. I think the 2 months was an effort, a diplomatic effort by the State Department to try to reverse that coup d'etat. And I think that they were trying to buy time, give themselves the opportunity to both rally the region, but also to try to sow some dissent within the military junta there to bring back President Bazoum, who remains under essentially house arrest. So that 2 months is really not ignorance of the fact that a coup d'etat had happened, but really an effort by the State Department to reverse it.
Yes, so French troops departed Niger today. What about U.S. troops? I mean, there is a really important drone base that the U.S. built and uses for surveillance of all the nearby hotspots on the continent. What's going to happen with all that?
Well, what we've seen the Defense Department say just in the last few days is that they are consolidating American forces on two bases, two drone bases that they continue to maintain. But they've made very clear that those drone bases are for the benefit of U.S. intelligence collection, that intelligence is not being shared with the military junta in Niger. It is not being operationalized by that junta. Washington has, I think, consolidated, made a much smaller footprint for itself. So it is both not a target itself, but that is able to keep eyes and ears on the region.
There's also a $302 million program aimed at building up Niger's regional transportation infrastructure between its capital, Niamey, and neighboring Benin. That's a big price tag. What makes that an important project?
Well, again, Niger, you have to remember, just look at the map of Africa, is a landlocked country. And so this was an essential lifeline to create a trade and commerce corridor to the Atlantic Ocean. And so it was, yes, tying Benin into the larger region, but it was giving it access to the sea, which it had not had previously. And so it's going to take away a lot of potential to grow the economy, to create jobs, and to create linkages with other parts of the region, which brings about stability.
Yeah, I mean, really important programs. Do you think any of this is likely to affect the coup leaders' decision-making?
Where people's pocketbooks are immediately affected, I think you will start to see some discontent among the population. So we saw this week that the junta has had to cut the annual budget by 40% to take into account not just U.S. development assistance that's been lost, but European, World Bank, IMF, all of the international financial institutions and bilateral donors have suspended their development programs in Niger.
So regarding the big worry in the room, the jihadist problem in Niger, there are various armed Islamic fundamentalist groups with ideological ties to ISIS. They're roaming vast stretches of the desert and the Sahel, places that are not being policed, attacking Nigerian troops and towns. Is this Niger's most direct existential threat right now?
Absolutely. I think that if you just look at the numbers, since the junta came into power 2 months ago, more Nigerian civilians have died in the last 2 months than in the last 18 months combined from terrorist threats. So you can see already that the ability of the Nigerian to combat this threat has eroded greatly with the withdrawal of U.S. and French and other allied forces. The terrorist movements in this country now see a new opportunity.
I mean, what do you see as the worst case scenario when you talk about those consequences?
Well, I think we can look at neighboring countries like Mali and Burkina Faso, which already have upwards of 70% of the countries there controlled by terrorist forces. Many of these forces in Niger are much closer to the capital, Niamey, than they are in countries like Mali or Burkina Faso. And so you could actually see the capital be sacked by terrorist forces. And so Niger could well become a terrorist-governed state. That would really be a worst-case scenario for Washington.
Cameron Hudson is a former National Security Council official and CIA analyst who helped advise the countries neighboring Niger in the wake of the coup d'etat there 2 months ago. Cameron, thank you for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Australia is on the brink of a historic decision. This Saturday, voters will decide whether to recognize Indigenous Australians in the nation's constitution and whether to create a permanent advisory body for them. Whatever the outcome, it's a major moment for race relations in Australia. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has been covering the referendum from Sydney. Earlier this week, she reported on what supporters hope it will accomplish and the opposition from conservatives who argue the advisory body would give Indigenous people special treatment. Today, Sarah reports there's another no camp, and it's among Aboriginal people themselves.
In 2017, hundreds of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people gathered at Uluru, a sacred spot in the Australian outback. They were there for a constitutional convention. Indigenous people aren't acknowledged or given rights in the Australian Constitution. And for close to 100 years, Indigenous activists have been fighting for some form of recognition in the country's founding document, some guarantee that the discrimination of the past will not be repeated. In the end, they came up with a document called the Uluru Statement from the Heart, the First Nations voice to Parliament. That advisory body made up of Indigenous people was the centerpiece.
We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution.
enshrined in the Constitution so it can't be swept away by a change of government. Since 1967, there have been several elected indigenous bodies, but they were all ripped apart when a different political party came to power. The Voice to Parliament, which will be put before voters this weekend, would advise Parliament and the executive branch on matters affecting Indigenous Australians. It would have no veto power and could only make recommendations. Here's Megan Davis, a co-author of the Uluru Statement from the Heart.
It gets us a seat at the table, and that's something that we don't have now.
Too often, she says, policies are forced on Indigenous people without their input, and that's why they fail. Indigenous Australians make up 3% of the population, but they account for more than a quarter of the prison population. And a third of Indigenous Australians live below the poverty line. Advocates say it's time for something different. But at the Uluru Summit, support for the plan was not universal. A group of 7 delegates walked out in protest. Gwenda Stanley, a Gomeroi woman and activist, was one of them.
Our concern's always been about Aboriginal sovereignty and land rights in this country, which has not been addressed, and the injustices.
Stanley is part of what's been called the Progressive Black No Camp. She'll vote no on the referendum this weekend because she thinks constitutional recognition, the Voice proposal, it's all a distraction. She says Aboriginal people need to focus on the big stuff,
which is giving our people back land and paying for the compensation and reparations of the genocides and the continual genocide of dispossession and annihilation of our people.
Stanley confronted the government's minister for Indigenous Australians, herself an Indigenous woman promoting The Voice, at a televised Q&A last year.
You are only of the interest of the Crown. Where is the interest of us as Indigenous Australians, First Nation, Gomeroi people, the first impact by colonialism, while we still have these governments and these Liberal Labor parties still making decisions on our affairs? We do not support the Uluru Statement. Why are we still trying to integrate into a system that systemically oppresses us?
The minister's answer was essentially, this is what we can get past. But the Progressive No Camp isn't having it. They want a treaty with land rights and self-government. Australia is the only Commonwealth country that doesn't have a treaty with its Indigenous people. Another argument from the Progressive No Camp is that The Voice is toothless. It's just an advisory body without any real power. Megan Krakauer is an anti-suicide advocate and Menang woman. She says her people don't need empty symbolism.
Look, with the work that I do with the National Suicide Prevention Trauma Recovery Project, we work with families where there's been a suicide, death in custody, homelessness. So in terms of where we're going to right now with The Voice, it is a very low bar.
Krakauer was ready to vote no, but then she says something shifted for her when she was at yet another funeral.
It was only a young one, 23 years young. He'd been in the Banksia Hill Detention Centre and he took his life and he now leaves behind 2 children. That broke my heart. So that's when I came forward and I said, who am I to say no to this?
Krakauer now plans to vote yes for the First Nations Voice to Parliament and constitutional recognition.
It may not offer everything that we want. It may not offer any compelling changes, but it may be a step in the right direction. I don't know.
I do understand the argument, something is better than nothing, but is something bad better than nothing at all?
This is Kelly Menzel. She's a Ngerjuri woman and an Associate Dean of Education at Southern Cross University in New South Wales. Menzel says, on the one hand, voting yes would mean putting her faith in the government and in the system.
Most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people don't trust the government processes because of the 280 years of proven reasons not to trust.
But on the other hand, she says, voting no feels like siding with racists.
For the no vote to be successful would be like Australia going, we're racist and we know it, clap our hands. Like it's almost shouting to the rest of the world that we're racist and that we don't care about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples dying before other people in the community.
So she feels stuck and undecided. The official Vote Yes campaign has been saying that a vote for The Voice is a vote for reconciliation, a way to finally do right by the country's Indigenous people. Most Indigenous people are behind it, more than 80%, according to polls. But as Kelly Menzel says, Indigenous people in this country are not a monolith.
There are now 250 nation groups in Australia. We aren't homogenous. We are vastly culturally different across Australia. It's a massive place.
With a massive number of opinions and many shades of grey. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
Next time in our series on the Australian referendum, the voice to parliament was billed as a simple idea that all Australians could get behind. Instead, it has become a front in the culture war dividing the nation. Before the war between Hamas and Israel broke out on Saturday, Israel and Saudi Arabia were on the verge of normalizing relations. 2 weeks ago, Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, told Fox News that the possibility seemed real for the first time.
Every day we get closer. It seems it's for the first time a real one, serious. We're going to see how it goes.
Just last month, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu predicted that a diplomatic advance with Saudi Arabia could lead to lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Now the prospects of normalization appear uncertain at best. To understand where things stand today, we've reached out to Greg Karlstrom. He's a Middle East correspondent with The Economist and joins us from Abu Dhabi. How is this normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia actually supposed to work, Greg?
Well, it was supposed to happen soon. If you listen to the White House, I'm not entirely convinced that it was. But the line from the White House and from the Saudis and from the Israelis was that we were getting close to a three-way deal. So Saudi Arabia would agree to normal diplomatic relations with Israel. America would offer incentives to the Saudis. They've talked about signing a defense treaty, something perhaps like the treaties America has with its NATO allies, might also offer more advanced weapons to Saudi Arabia and support with setting up a Saudi nuclear program. And then the Israelis were supposed to offer, as their part of this, some concessions towards the Palestinians, things to not reach a two-state solution, but make the occupation marginally less painful for Palestinians.
Was it clear to all parties what normalization actually meant and what the end game was?
The end game was something not unlike the Abraham Accords, the deal signed in 2020 that saw first the UAE, then Bahrain, then Sudan and Morocco all agree to recognize Israel.
Yeah, so prior to this attack by Hamas on Israel, things were moving more or less in that direction.
I think they were. I mean, I think the prospect of Israeli-Saudi normalization, it's always been a matter of when, not if. They see common interests. They have common strategic interests. When it comes to security, they both, for years, have seen Iran as their major threat in the Middle East. And they have a decade now of quiet security coordination, sharing intelligence and talking about the Iranian threat. And so the idea was to try and make that official, to take what has been an under-the-table relationship for a number of years and make it public.
And now, obviously, the war interrupts normalization efforts, but are the negotiations between Israel and Saudi, are they on pause or pretty much dead for the foreseeable future?
They're certainly on pause for two reasons, one of which is that the Israeli government is, of course, preoccupied with its domestic situation right now, with Israeli security, with what looks like a looming ground invasion of Gaza. And so that has become the only political priority for Israel right now. That also, from the Saudi perspective, means this is not a good time to do it. We are going to see if there is what seems like a likely ground invasion. We are going to see weeks, if not months, of scenes of fighting between the Israeli army and Palestinian militants in Gaza. And there's images of which we've already seen over the past few days of airstrikes, of dead civilians in Gaza. That's not for the Saudis a good backdrop to normalize relations with Israel. It's not a good backdrop for anyone in the Arab world to do it.
Is there any possibility Hamas intentionally attacked Israel to thwart or derail this process? What do you know about that?
There are people who have floated that theory, and I've heard it particularly from analysts in America who think that was the intention. I don't place a whole lot of stock in that. I think first, this attack was likely in the works for many months. It was a very complicated attack, and it's not something that was pulled together in the past few weeks. It's only been a few months that Israeli-Saudi normalization seemed like something that was imminent. So the timing doesn't make sense. I think Hamas attacking Israel on Saturday had a lot more to do with their own domestic politics than it did with the geopolitics of normalization.
I mean, it's hard to say, Greg, where these normalization efforts go from here. But do you think the White House's approach, both under Trump and Biden, of striking deals with Israel's Arab neighbors will come back to haunt them.
I think it's a very short-sighted way to approach the Middle East. The idea has been that if Israel and Arab states can work together, that first we will have this security architecture in the region that will be able to counterbalance Iran. And second, that if we resolve the broader Israeli-Arab conflict, we can go some ways towards resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as well. The second part of that, the idea that normalization with Gulf states could pressure the Palestinians into accepting a settlement not on very good terms, we're also seeing that clearly that isn't the case. So it was a lot of misguided thinking on the part of two successive administrations to think that the central focus of America's Middle East policy should be Israeli-Arab normalization, and that would magically make the Israeli-Palestinian conflict go away. We've seen in most gruesome and spectacular fashion over the past few days that it has not.
Greg Karlstrom is the Middle East correspondent for The Economist. He joined us from Abu Dhabi. Greg, really appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's a little world trivia for you. Name the only country in the Western Hemisphere with a state religion. I'll give you a hint. It's in Central America. It's about the size of West Virginia. And its citizens call themselves Ticos. If you guess Costa Rica, pat yourself on the back. The state religion is Catholicism. Now, what happens when the president of that officially Catholic country is elected, promising to lift evangelical voices? The world's Michael Fox went to find out. Gloria,
Gloria. The Catholic Church in the Caribbean town of Puerto Viejo is a simple one-story building a block from the waterfront. Cream-colored walls, six long wooden pews on each side. It's packed for service on Sunday afternoon. Like millions across Costa Rica, Digna Maria Fajardo attends every week with her husband and two children. For me, the church is the most important. It's the best, she says. It's also constitutionally mandated. The country has religious freedom, but the designation means that the state goes out of its way to support the church. Between 2010 and 2015, for example, the government provided over $6 million to the Catholic Church. But Catholicism is not the only game in town. Down the street from Puerto Viejo's Catholic Church, members of an Assembly of God Pentecostal congregation are worshiping in a new building. It's not quite ready. Even the light fixtures aren't in yet. Concrete floors, stark white walls, metal chairs, a simple stage on one end. Today, evangelicals make up roughly 28% of the population of Costa Rica. And the whole state religion thing, it does not sit well with many. Berta Cortez has been an active member of the Assembly of God congregation here for four decades. No, she says. There shouldn't be the support for just one religion. The country should not be like this, but we all have different ways of thinking and believing what we believe. Nevertheless, analysts say that in practice, the designation means little. Claire Nevache-Well is a doctoral student at the Free University of Brussels and a researcher in religion at the International Center for Political Studies. All political actors in the country, both on the right and the left, she says, recognize that in practice, the Costa Rican state is practically secular. And in fact, current President Rodrigo Chavez has been moving in the opposite direction, actively embracing evangelicals and their cause. Chavez is a Trump-inspired nationalist politician, an economist who worked for three decades at the World Bank and who was largely a political outsider ahead of his presidential victory last year.
Me comprometo a uno, no apoyar.
Just a week out from the runoff vote, he signed a pact with a handful of prominent evangelical pastors. That's him promising to eliminate so-called gender ideology in schools, fight abortion, promote evangelical positions in his government, and collaborate actively with the evangelical church.
Levantar su mano derecha. Juráis a Dios y prometéis a la patria.
For his inauguration, he was sworn in with a Bible, not common practice in Costa Rica. He also asked for the ceremony to be blessed both by a Catholic priest and an evangelical pastor. Nevache-Well says this was the first time this had happened in the country. If you look at this in its historical context, this was a really big thing, she says. It was a signal to evangelicals and a major shift from the past. Many evangelicals appreciate his support. Cassandra Barahona attends service at Puerto Viejo's Evangelical God of Prophecy Church. It's a small, cozy building with only enough room for a couple dozen people inside. We are really happy that the president is taking the evangelical churches into account, she says. Some leading evangelical pastors have also been outspoken in favor of the president. I'm not political, said one pastor in August in a video shared over YouTube. But this is the first time we have had a president, because all the others have been miserable. He called opposing politicians from the devil. Chavez's own speeches have been riddled with religious references, but not only in support of the country's evangelicals. André Piñera Sancho is a researcher at Costa Rica State University, UNED.
Chávez hace un uso más bien utilitario de gestos y expresiones religiosas.
Chávez makes utilitarian use of gestures and religious expressions, which can both be Catholic or evangelical, he says. He covers both groups by being conveniently ambiguous, but overall, he continues to show sympathy with the conservative cause. Religious ambiguity has become a powerful component of the discourse of many of Latin America's nationalist leaders. Like former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, Rodrigo Chávez is Catholic, but he also caters to the millions of evangelicals in the country. Nivash Wells says this is a common thread among the right-wing populists in the region and their way of appealing to as broad a sector of the Christian population as possible. They try to cultivate this certain ambiguity regarding their religious affiliation, she says. We see it with Rodrigo Chávez. We saw it with former Peruvian dictator Alberto Fujimori. We see it with Bolsonaro and also El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele. As for the question of Costa Rica's constitutionally mandated Catholicism, early in his campaign for the presidency last year, Rodrigo Chávez said he was deeply religious, but believed the country should be a secular state. That, however, is no longer something most leading evangelicals in the country are clamoring for, and Chávez knows it. Why? Because having a state religion helps them with their common moral cause against issues such as abortion, LGBT rights, and same-sex marriage. César Zúñiga is a political scientist and a congressional advisor. He says this moral agenda has paradoxically meant that evangelical groups rather tend to defend the Catholic state religion, because they presume, and rightfully so, that this is a kind of constitutional safeguard against the emergence of these ideas in the country's politics. In other words, in Costa Rica, when it comes to the moral agenda, Catholics and evangelicals are largely on the same page. So is President Rodrigo Chávez. And they see the state religion as a tool to protect Christian values, regardless of their denomination. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Puerto Viejo, Costa Rica.
At the start of our program today, we reported on Israel's northern border. That's where concerns are growing about whether Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon may expand the war that started this weekend in southern Israel between Israel and Hamas. Join us tomorrow on The World when our reporter in Lebanon will have the latest, along with all the day's global news. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and thank you for listening.